This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, I'm sure you've heard of Athletic Greens from a thousand different other podcasts, but the reason why I think this is the case is because it works. I've been using it for years, and the biggest benefits that I've realized is that it gives me more energy. I feel like I'm getting a full and healthy diet. My poops are better, and I'm sorry to say, but it's true. And so if you're somebody who really wants a healthy diet where they're confident they're getting all their micronutrients, go on and head over to drinkag1.com/Farzad. drinkag1.com/Farzad, where you'll get a free vitamin D plus K2 bottle and 5 free travel packs. Thank you so much to Athletic Greens. And now onto the podcast. We had some major events happen in the last few couple of years that could, you know, for some could extrapolate to say, hey, freedom of speech is at risk. It's being attacked. There are some clear, unquestioned actions by the United States government where they've taken steps to try and silence dissent, even if it's isolated, right? It started with the Twitter files, and there was a subsegment of the population that was probably like, yeah, may have happened, may have not. I have better things to worry about. Stuff is broken sometimes. It is what it is. Let's move on, right? Then the letter from Zuckerberg came out from Meta, literally reinforcing what the Twitter files was saying, which is the United States government was putting a giant amount of pressure on social media platforms to silence things that people were saying that weren't even directly challenging what the government was trying to do or what they really deemed as like hate speech or bad speech or misinformation, disinformation, literally just jokes. The government was asking Meta, and you know, by association, I'm guessing Twitter/X and Google and YouTube and stuff like that, to take that stuff down. So now you have a precedence for, hey, we can silence jokes, okay? Then my own two eyes, what I saw, specifically around content that I published on YouTube, okay? Which, by the way, I think YouTube is a great platform all in all, but this was very hard to ignore, was that there was a interview between RFK and Elon Musk that was on X Spaces, you know, and people that follow this channel know that we take those X Spaces, we edit them down so that they're easy to listen to. We boost the audio. We basically repackage it so that it's easy to find, easy to take in, right? And when we first published that interview, YouTube immediately took it down for COVID misinformation. Immediately, right? Even though COVID was not really discussed on the platform, on the podcast, on the space, which told me that, okay, so RFK Jr. automatically is on a ban list. Automatically, doesn't matter what he's saying, he's automatically on a ban list. So I was like, that is very, very strange. That's very strange. Then I made a post about that on X, and then magically, within a few hours, I got a message from YouTube saying, oh, that was a mistake. My bad. Sorry. That was a mistake. Let's fix it, right? But then I noticed that the interview, nothing happened to it for a long time. It was just kind of like getting 10 views a day, maybe less. Right. And then after Elon Musk bought X, and he had that space with Alex Jones and Andrew Tate and Vivek Ramaswamy. It was just like that psychotic group of misfits, right? Just a wild, wild thing. We did the same exact thing. We posted that thing on YouTube, right? And I was like, okay, like this, it's going to happen again. There's no way this goes through. There's no way. And then to my surprise, what happened? That thing went crazy viral, right? And so then what my assumption was like, okay, so it looks like YouTube has opened the floodgates. Something has happened ever since Elon Musk bought X and he went hardcore into the free speech thing, regardless if you believe he's doing it for the right reasons or not, or if he's actually doing it, forget that. YouTube now had a stark different policy when it came to things that previously you couldn't talk about that is now acceptable to talk about. And the reason being, Alex Jones, for people that listen to even 1% of what he says, I don't listen to the guy, but that space I listen to, and I'm aware of what he likes to talk about. He was persona non grata, right? Like, just not allowed, cannot say anything. And now YouTube's like, oh yeah, sure, but this one we can, no problem, right? I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Let me repost the RFK Jr. interview and see if something has changed, right? Lo and behold, that thing goes viral too. I'm like, okay, wow. So the fact that that happened means that previously you couldn't do that, but now you can, right? So something changed. And now I'm watching this thing that's happening in Brazil, excuse me, this thing that's happening in Brazil, right? And I'm very curious to get your take on this, Hans, because you tell me if I'm, I don't know how much work you've done to really truly look into this. I'm going off of the information on X. So one could say maybe I'm quote unquote biased on this, but I think based on what I just described, I think if Elon Musk, let's say Elon Musk or X are saying, hey, there's probably something shady going on here with free speech, they have a pretty good track record now, I would say, okay? Then this whole Brazil thing is like, okay, there is a thing going on where in Brazil, there is freedom of speech laws that allow people to have freedom of speech. But X is arguing that Brazil, there's two individuals, basically the president and the one judicial guy, I forget his exact name, the Moraes or something like that. The guy that, you know, the meme with he looks like Voldemort, right? Which is, I think it's a pretty sick look, but I can totally see why people would view him as such. The argument is like, okay, so, and that's what they're posting on X now. They're posting all these letters and stuff, and, you know, I'll put a snapshot of it here on screen, that they are, Brazil is breaking its own laws by asking X to essentially remove and delete posts from people that they view as opposition to the party that's in right now. And then X is saying, no, because we are for free speech if your country upholds those laws. Like, we're going to follow the laws of your land. And if the laws of your land allow this to happen and you're asking me to take it down, we are not going to do it. Very similar to what, I mean, exactly the same than what that platform has done in the United States, right? And what I find very interesting here, very, very interesting here, is that if that's true, right? If that's true, and I'm curious to see, hear your opinion if you believe that's true or not. Number one, why isn't the United States government, the Biden-Harris administration, who, you know, from my understanding, the First Amendment of the United States is freedom of speech. Why aren't they, let's say, coming to the defense of X, an American company that is being forcefully shut down in Brazil, which is going to prevent X from collecting any revenue and operating in that country, which is essentially damaging an American company that is trying to uphold, as per, you know, based on what X is saying, freedom of speech, right? How come the United States government is not saying like, yo, that's wrong? Like, when is the last time the US government hasn't taken the ability to virtue signal is on a platter for the United States government? I've seen them take it time and time again. Freedom, you know, democracy, freedom of speech, you know, the American dream, giving everybody, you know, the choice to live their whole lives, you know, freedom, liberty, justice for all, the rule of law. Bro, like, I mean, how many times have we heard this? And then this happens and there's like silence. Silence, right? So that's weird to me. So what's happening, Hans? Am I just barking up? Like, are these dumb questions? Can you help me understand, please?
Well, I don't know if they're dumb questions. They are definitely the types of questions that it seems like people are not supposed to be asking, though. Although in the age of the internet, it's hard to keep people from asking questions and making speculation. I think that, so one of the things that I'll say is when there's a thing that Eric Weinstein has mentioned recently, that he says you see the gaps in reality when two things that should go together fail to meet. And I'm butchering his specific articulation of it, but this is, you know, basically the idea is essentially a glitch in the matrix.
Like, this is the Chris Williamson podcast, right?
Yeah.
That by the way, I listened to the first half of it, by the way. It's like, it's so good. I recommend everybody go check it out. Chris Williamson with Eric Weinstein from the last couple of days. Sorry, go ahead.
Didn't mean to. Yeah. I mean, pretty mind-bending things. I do really appreciate Eric Weinstein as a critical thinker. I've listened to, gosh, I don't know, many, many tens, potentially 100 plus hours of him thinking through complex things. And the thing that I like about him the best is he's one of the people who keeps himself from falling just off on the conspiracy crazy train while trying to think through, okay, what are the likely scenarios that are at play here? What's the likely dynamics of the, whatever the underlying structure is of some of these things that seem very odd, where you know, publicly our policy is X, but it seems like we never accomplish X or even come close to accomplishing X. It seems like we tend to accomplish the opposite of X instead of X. That's really weird. And so, you know, he digs into this quite a bit. But all of that to be said, it does, you know, raise, I think it's a very, very valid question to ask, wait a second, why isn't the U.S. State Department looking out for the interests of X and Elon Musk? But then when you step back and you realize, well, the Biden-Harris administration has pretty much hated Elon. You know, they use him when they can. But it seems to me like a logical extension of the last 4 years of lawfare against him, that of course they're not going to defend someone that seems to be pretty high on the list of persona non gratas in their estimation. You know, beyond Donald Trump, is there anyone that you can think of besides Putin that the Biden-Harris administration has specifically targeted to a greater degree as an enemy of the administration?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. At least, let's say, a individual that they've gone out of their way to ensure that the public feels that they are in some way, shape, or form bad people, or bad for business, or bad for society. That's the vibe I'm getting. Which is like the Elon angle is an odd one, because the comment you made is like, okay, so he, like, they don't have to use him, you know, unless they can. Like, I would say they don't use him unless they desperately have to, right? Like SpaceX is single-handedly rescuing and enabling the United States to go to space. Without SpaceX, it doesn't happen, because Boeing is a disaster. I read a comment that said, I say Boeing weird, by the way. Boeing. Which, you know, might as well call him Boeing, because it's like, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Anyway, so let's set that aside. So if I use Starlink as an example, right? Starlink, the same exact thing that SpaceX has proven out, which is you have a technology that you've created that is able to deliver to at a much higher quality, much more often, at a fraction of the cost, right? Which is broadband internet in rural areas, right? The administration is saying you don't qualify for this because, you know, you're not ready to do it, even though they're doing it right now. And so, and this was on social media the last few days. So what happened is the United States has a grant for broadband internet in the United States, where companies can basically get paid from the government to build out broadband internet
for
rural users specifically, yeah. Right? And then Starlink is like, yo, check this out. We're literally doing this already. People are paying $100 a month, whatever it is. They pay $500 for the satellite dish, and people have broadband internet, and you can see it. Like, you can see everyone's post online. You got people playing COD now, you know, and they're able to like have headshots while they're playing the game in middle of nowhere Kentucky or middle of nowhere Oklahoma, right? And you would, you could not do that before. That was just literally impossible because the, it, because the satellite internet that was there was stupid. Like, it was a million miles away, literally. And the it was too expensive to run fiber, right? And Starlink is like, yo, we already have this. And the U.S. government is saying, no, you can't have that money, right? And but there's no reasonable justifications. They're just saying no. And instead, what they're going to do, they're going to give it to a bunch of companies that will do it at multiple times more expensive cost than Starlink would do it, and it questionable performance. And they're probably going to price gouge the hell out of the customers there, right?
We've already given out billions of dollars for this initiative, and we have connected exactly zero users.
Right.
For billions of dollars worth of free money to telcos. And, you know, the way that they're connecting these people is they're digging, you know, traditional internet lines out to people and laying it underground. So, of course, it's going to be really, really expensive. But, you know, is that a feature or a bug? I think if you're a telco company, that's a feature. You, that is exactly what you want government to do. You want them to tell Elon and SpaceX to F off and give me that free money that I'm going to waste. And how many of those dollars are going to make it into the hands of somebody who's digging a ditch? My guess is probably not very many. It's probably going into the hands of management and lobbyists and a whole number of people who are just riding that gravy train.
Yeah. And so that beautifully said. And so the overarching point there is, like, unless they have to rely on this guy's companies, which now have reached a point, like him or not, go ahead.
Well, and the only way that they, you know, the only two places where they finally will rely on him are if they're publicly shamed into it to a degree that they just cannot ignore, or there is a capability that they need strategically that they cannot get anywhere else. Those are the only two areas where they will do business with him.
Which is very strange, right? Which is just a very strange dynamic, because for anybody who has tried the technologies, and I know God knows we know all about the Tesla haters. Do we know about them very well, right? The only reason why Tesla's getting electric vehicle tax credits in the United States is because in early 2023, when the EV tax credit first came out, they were completely omitted from being able to get the EV tax credit, even though they 100%
were. For the Model Y specifically.
For the Model Y specifically, thank you, which was the best-selling car, and which for 2023, and again, it's going to be for 2024, is the trend. And there had to be public outcry and petitions to force the United States government to change this weird exception they made for the Tesla Model Y, either by accident or on purpose, right? So if that wouldn't have happened,
if it's on accident, why do you keep seeing it in other areas like the rural broadband thing?
At this point, it can't be an accident, right? Which then, so, and it goes back to the Brazil thing, right? This whole thing goes back to the Brazil thing, which is, I think what this exposes is that there's absolutely preferential treatment, 1,000%. Either preferential treatment or the opposite of that, whatever you want to define that as. Like, unpreferential treatment. Whatever, what's the right word, Hans? Help me. English is not my first language.
Anti-preferential treatment? I don't know. I'm not exactly even sure better. What you're going for.
That's what I'm going for. Like, going out of their way to ensure that that person doesn't get something that they're very much entitled to getting. Right?
Yeah, discrimination. Like outright discrimination.
Outright. That's what it seems like to me. And again, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm right, right? That's just what it feels like. That's what it seems like. That's what it smells like. That's what it looks like. And I can't just sit here and say it's probably something else. You know, it's probably something, I don't know. You know how I like to say don't attribute to malice, you know, what can be described as incompetence. I don't think this is incompetence. Like, this specific dynamic where it's very obvious how they're treating this one individual and his businesses, that doesn't feel like incompetence to me. It feels like something more. Now, the question becomes why? Why are they doing that, right? Let's assume we're right. And we say, okay, why are they, puts politics aside. Okay. I'm not saying this is not an endorsement for Trump. This is not a de-endorsement or an anti-endorsement of Kamala Harris. I'm just trying to ask reasonable questions on a thing that we follow closely. Why would they do this? If this is true, why would they do it?
Well, this is a question that I've been asking diligently for the past few weeks. And let me go on one side tangent real quick. Okay, we talked about last week that, or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, the letter that Mark Zuckerberg put out, and he was very apologetic for his reluctant participation in the censorship of Americans and vital information to elections. If he has come to Jesus, and if he truly is redeemed on free speech and censorship, why is Facebook still operating in Brazil? Where are the public statements by Meta officials about the requests that are being sent to them by the Brazilian governments that are in violation of Brazilian law? Where is the pushback that he said, you know, we now have structures in place to resist these censorship probes by the government? You know, this is a question that we don't have specific answers to, but the deafening silence on this front makes me highly, highly suspicious that Mark Zuckerberg is in fact meaningfully changed on the subject. Okay, sorry. Rant over, coming back from the side trail. There are three different people who I have listened to or read extensively on this subject that paint an overall narrative that I feel like makes sense in this situation. And the core of it starts with, so those three people, I'll give you their names. They're Martin Gurry. He's a former CIA analyst and was part of their global media division that just analyzed the flow of information around the world. He wrote a book called The Revolt of the Public, which is excellent. And the thesis of Revolt of the Public is that in the early days of the internet and specifically social media, that the general population had an ability to exchange information that gave them a new superpower that they had never had in the history of humanity before. And that was the ability to call bullshit on the official one true narrative within side of a government. And so in the past, when we lived in an era where the information that you got was either through newspapers or books or eventually television, these were very one-way communication methods, and they were very centralized. That the book publishers, the newspaper men, the media outlets, that they were the ones doing the communication of the story out to the people. And the people didn't have a way to comment on that and say, yeah, I think this is right. I think that's wrong. That two-way exchange of information en masse did not exist. Right.
Exactly.
Yes. And so after the advent of the internet, all of a sudden, well, now everyone can comment on the news and they can say, I believe this part, I don't believe that part. You know, a lot of people look back on the Walter Cronkite era as, oh, you know, this is the greatest time in American history. We were so unified, you know, we could just listen to Walter Cronkite and he would give us what we needed to know. And at the end, that's the way it was. Was that ever the way it was? I don't think so. I think it's just that he was the only one with a megaphone. So all the people who said horse crap didn't have a voice. And now they have a voice. And so what this gives rise to is the ability of people to unify around the fact that they don't believe that the official narrative is in fact legitimate, and they can unify in a desire to reject that authority. And so this is the genesis of things like the Arab Spring and any number of populist uprisings around the world. And at first, we kind of liked that because democracy. We want to empower The individual against totalitarian governments. Woohoo! And, you know, that's great as long as the totalitarian government that is being opposed is some faraway country who has resources that we kind of want and whose dictators aren't really cooperating with us. And it sure would be nice if they just magically disappeared. But when that totalitarian government has a president whose name is Joe Biden, or I don't know, Obama, something like that, well, now this is a very, very, very dangerous piece of technology that we cannot stand to allow to be at work. And so, you know,
well, you know, before you keep going, you know, automatically the commenters are going to go like, wow, look at this Trump supporter. Look at this wonderful Trump supporter. What do you have to say about that?
So I'm not voting for Trump. That's what I'll say about that. But the thing is not, you know, whether it's Trump in the United States, whether it's Marie Le Pen in France, whether it's Boris Johnson in England, that we've seen, this is not a United States specific phenomenon, that there has been, since the invention of social media, a sweeping global trend of populist uprisings of people that say, I don't know who these institutions are that think that they're doing such a great job, but they suck. They're not working for us. We want something different. And whatever it is that is not normal institutional bologna sauce, we'll vote for it. Like, because it's not a vote for Trump. It is a vote against the established governmental system. It's a vote against Washington. It's a vote against the swamp in the specific contents or context of the United States. But like I said, the same has been true all over Europe, all around the world. And so this is the dynamic that we're kind of wrestling with. So then that brings us to, you know, another thinker who is Mike Benz, that he goes into detail about how, you know, the...
And sorry, Mike Benz is who?
He is a... I don't know. He was in the cabinet of Trump, actually. But really, I have very little understanding of his background other than I've just listened to his explanation. And so far, everything that I've checked into to, you know, fact check his sources on this has turned out to be correct. But his claimed area of expertise is the United States State Department and the surrounding ecosystem of civilian, like basically money that flows from somewhere in the government to a whole number of institutions that are funded by taxpayer dollars, but are not necessarily officially the government. So a lot of these are going to be academic institutions, or policy institutions, a bunch of nonprofits. And he describes how in basically from 2016 until 2020, after they were shocked and surprised by the fact that even though Hillary Clinton was 90% likely to win the election against, you know, crazy Donald Trump, all of a sudden he's the president and we can't let that happen again. And so they begin building this massive online censorship apparatus that we then saw basically in, you know, its full glory during COVID, its ability to immediately shut down any conversation, whether it was a joke, an opinion, or a world-renowned scientist who was a subject matter expert on the thing that was in question, presenting facts and data and analyses that were contrary to the desired narrative, just poof, gone, erased from the internet, unpersoned digitally. So that system didn't just magically poof into existence you know, in 2020 and 2021. That was a system that was built for a number of years prior to that for the specific purpose of now combating this challenge that we were talking about with Martin Gurry, that the authority figures in the institutions who hold the positions of power needed a valid way to defend their institutional power and position and ability to make decisions unopposed from the masses who were sometimes rightly and sometimes wrongly criticizing them for using the wrong data or making the wrong decisions or just straight out lying. And that, the two conversations that Mike Benz had with Tucker Carlson over the past 6 months are exceptional explanations, you know, if you buy it from him on how that whole machine, that censorship machine, was built and how it operates and who it is that controls that machine. And it's not something that is some bot farm in Russia or China. That is actually owned, operated, controlled by elements of the United States government and funded by your and my taxpayer dollars. And so then we kind of get to point three, which is, okay, obviously it seems very uncomfortable that the more we look out at the world, that the United States appears to be one of the leading threats to actual democracy and free speech around the globe, even though we're supposed to be defenders of those things. And they've redefined democracy from being of the people, by the people, for the people, to the defense of these critical institutions like schools and Congress and the House and the NIH and the White House itself, that these institutions are democracy. It's not the people. And these institutions must be defended from the threat of the people. And so this is, you know, going back to Martin Gurry's framing, like the center must be defended from the masses. The institutions must be defended from the masses. This is no longer government of the people, by the people, for the people. This is government for the elites, by the elites, at gunpoint. And that, that's a very uncomfortable position to hold. But then, to give the devil their due somewhat, you also have to factor in the reality that we live in a world where nuclear weapons exist and biological weapons exist. And there's a lot of very uncomfortable technology and information that it's easy to circulate in an internet age. And maybe one of the only things standing between us and nuclear holocaust is one of these institutions that, on the face of it, it would seem that we should burn it all down. That is Trump's stated goal at this point in time. Is, you know, last time he didn't have a very good game plan for drain the swamp, but assembling a group of people like RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard and Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to be very well-informed hatchet men to go in and start cutting up a lot of this government bureaucracy and bloat. It is definitely conceivable. I'm not making this argument, but I can understand someone making this argument that while they may have good intentions, they might actually cut down something structural that stands in between the existing world order that, while not perfect, is vastly preferable to many states of history in the past. And they cannot be allowed to tear down something that is preventing a future that looks more like World War II or more like the 30 Years War or, you know, some of these times of tremendous chaos and human suffering. So I would say that's kind of the situation as I see it. And what it points out is, as it relates to Brazil, and this will go back and reference Mike Benz, according to him in his analysis, that the forces that got the current president Lula elected in the first place were, you know, basically funded by, it was a soft regime change that was funded by and paid for the U.S. State Department. And the reason that we're not defending Elon Musk in Brazil is because X, as a populist free speech tool, is interfering with our ability to enact a soft power regime change in Brazil that apparently serves the interests of someone in the U.S. government for some specific reasons.
Yeah,
it's a very uncomfortable situation.
It sucks. I mean, listen, this has turned into a cookie conspiracy theory corner. I'm kidding. I think here's the issue with saying that this is complete lunacy is that we have very much, very solid evidence, actually proof and a real occurrence of the United States meddling like this in other countries for the last 60, 70, 80 years, ever since after World War II, just kind of imposing its will globally to get what it wants. Now, the ones that are pro-system will make the argument, like you said, that's like, well, the other side is worse. The opposite is worse, is that you need somebody with a tight grip, with a fist, in a sense, to like get what we think is right for our country. But then at that point, if those systems are in place and the population says, I don't think that's good, and we should try something different, so we need to rip off the Band-Aid and try something different, if the population is not able to do that, it's not really a democracy. It's not really a democracy. So like, why are we calling it a democracy then? At that point, we're just lying.
Why do we call the Inflation Reduction Act the Inflation Reduction Act? I mean, the more you look at this, the more you realize almost every major
Citizens United
government project, yeah, it's literally the exact opposite. You know, it's 1984 was supposed to be a work of fiction, not an instruction manual. And every day it seems like more and more of these things are exactly the way that we see our government operating, whether it's doublespeak or the Patriot Act. Yeah. And by patriot, I mean, all of you who feel patriotic towards our country, we are going to use your patriotism against you to spy on you, not terrorists, you. For all time, for the rest of history. Thanks, people.
Why are these conversations so uncomfortable? Why do they sound like conspiracy theories? And why does the mainstream media, a legacy media, why are they afraid to touch this? Like, is this really... Like, I'm trying to get my head wrapped around that, because I don't think it's false. I think, listen, I'm not saying we're 100% accurate, or I'm not even saying like we're mostly accurate, but we're definitely talking, we're trying to like pull on threads that are logical. We're just trying to be logical about our process, right? It just happens to be, the topic of conversation happens to be the United States government and how the systems in that country are operating. Like, why does that feel so controversial, you know? Or is it? Am I just projecting my insecurity? Did I put my finger in the pulse of something? Like, help me understand that.
There are a lot of system. Well, I mean, who are you? Are you an American? Yeah. I think that for people who identify themselves as American and believe in the ideal of the American project, confronting the reality of the impact that our government has in the world can be very uncomfortable, because if you believe that there is inherent moral value in something like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, and you think that those are good things, then asking questions about whether or not our government is living up to those ideals in an environment where it seems to be increasingly clear that they're not, that is, and like, you are asking for an identity crisis when you're doing that. Like, who am I? If I'm an American and America is just as likely to be an evil world supervillain entity as it is to be the greatest country ever known to man, that's very, very uncomfortable.
And how much of this is supercharged because we're in an election cycle and these conversations are much more uncomfortable because of how vitriolic and toxic the conversation is around this, because each side is trying to make the other side existential. And so these conversations become more difficult to have. What if it's just like the cycle that we're in? Is that a possibility?
It's definitely part of the thing, but, you know, like I said, we do live in a new world now with the advent of social media and the internet and the ability of 300 and some million Americans to all participate in a conversation about this at some level, regardless of how censored, adds fuel to a fire that just did not exist in the past. And so, yes, there have been a cycle like this, but it is somewhat different now. And then, you know, I think that that populist piece of it that allows someone like Donald Trump to win the nomination of the Republican Party. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about on this channel that I've witnessed on the Republican side and the Democratic side both is that there is a very, very, very effective filter mechanism that prevents candidates from reaching the debate stage to be elected as president who are not completely and wholly acceptable to some powerful group of constituents who get to make decisions. And so they're preventing good candidates who represent the interests of the people from ever becoming an option for us to vote for at the end of an election cycle. And I think that Donald Trump is one of the first people in, you know, potentially tens, if not hundreds of years, who has actually made it to the ballot at the end of the race, who is not under the thumb of whatever it is that filters those candidates out. And that is very problematic. And that's why every election that he has been a candidate in has had this much more supercharged, divisive, controversial feel to it.
But doesn't that by default mean that there's something there? Right? If we use like just a logical approach of saying, if a lot more people are going to be engaged, whatever toxic form or let's say hyperbolic or whatever, right? The fact that there's so much more noise, signal, whatever you want to call it, behind this, doesn't that mean that there's something there that we need to pay attention to versus the usual, like, you know, boring sort of like, oh, here we go, same playbook. It's basically you're getting this, you know, the same side, you know, two sides of the same coin, blah, 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 right? In some respects, doesn't the really different dynamic with these last, say, three elections, doesn't that point to something actually underneath that people are really, really, really concerned about that we need to talk about as a country? Like, forget saying either candidate is terrible or evil or beautiful and perfect. Like, there's something there that we need to fix that's very fundamental to what's going on. And we're not having those conversations. We're just basically, it's just what politics has been mudslinging for what feels like forever, at least as long as I've been in this country, it's we're not having those conversations. Like there's no way to have those conversations in, let's say, the legacy media. But now maybe the optimistic side of this conversation is that it's actually, we're starting to see a shift of it because we're having conversations like this. Like I'm seeing conversations like this all the time now. I wasn't seeing conversations like this before. Is this the healing process that we have to go through to actually get this thing fixed? Or do we take a more realistic approach and say that this is all going to get way worse before it gets better? Just like it has in every single other point in history.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it definitely, I think, is scary. I mean, one of the things that I'm going to depart from the Trump supporters on in this regard is I don't think Trump is particularly capable of leading intelligent reforms from the position of president. And I don't think he did. Like we saw how, you know, if what you wanted was drain the swamp when you voted for him the first time around, did you get that?
It got worse.
Seemed like the answer to that question is largely no. I mean, I will give him tons of credit for not getting us into any new wars. Now, that doesn't 100%. Mean that he got us out of wars that we were already in. Like, he was not, you know, extremely.
Yeah, but the effective. Swamp is there.
But the swamp is there. Yes.
This is my biggest, like, issue with Trump is, like, he sells himself as this fixer. And then it seems like it was. And doesn't fix. It doesn't, like, there's no fundamental fix. It was fixed while he was in there. But probably because he's pulling strings to make sure that he looks good doing it. But then once he bounces office, where is that like swamp that you were supposed to clean out, that where the government was supposed to actually react to the people? It got worse. It got worse, I would argue, right? So it's like, okay, what is that? Like, do you actually have the capability, or are you just talking as if you do, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if he will or won't. I think it would depend on him getting... You know, I think Trump plus RFK Jr., Elon, Tulsi, Vivek, like, I think that's a more likely group of people to produce the swamp drainage result that people are looking for than his previous cabinet. But whether they can actually be effective, I don't know. Like, and I have a hard time not just observing the fact that the last time a president declared war on the CIA publicly, he got assassinated, and Trump was almost assassinated a couple months ago. And that's basically, I mean, not even a couple, I thought it was a couple weeks ago, and it's already been memory hold. So, you know, I don't know what that is. It certainly seems very suspect. And I mean, yes, you know, Reagan was almost assassinated. He came very close to dying, but he didn't. But yeah, the last successful assassination was John F. Kennedy. And it sure is suspicious that we haven't declassified any of that information that was supposed to have already been declassified by now. And all of that went down right after he said, yeah, I think we need to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
It's weird. It's really weird. It's like, again, but it's like the thing for me is like, okay, why does this all feel like conspiracy theories? Why does it all feel wrong to talk about this? This
What's
is
wrong
my
with
thing.
Conspiracy theories.
No, I know. No, I agree.
Well, so yeah, I mean,
like
just,
if I use a color, like if I use like a like in a business world, right? If I think about the last, anytime I try to make a change or try to make something better, I have the business equivalent of conspiracy theories every second of my living. I'm constantly questioning everything that I do, everything that I work on, everything that we work on as a team, right? Everything gets questioned as often as I can, because I know that is the best way to find the right answer. But God forbid we do that as a society.
We do it all crazy. The time. And it is one of those examples of, you know, reality failing to close again, that, you know, here's a great conspiracy topic for people who support Tesla. Was there a concerted cover-up on the part of oil and gas companies to conceal the effect of emitting carbon into the atmosphere and the likely impact that was going to have on rising global temperatures for decades? Did that exist?
Right.
Yes. Like, right. Almost anyone who's bought a Tesla can agree, yeah, that happened. Okay, what is that? Is that not a conspiracy? I think that qualifies as a conspiracy. So conspiracies are things that actually happen relatively regularly. Let's do another example. Was there or was there not a giant conspiracy on the part of Philip Morris and all the other smoking companies for decades to conceal the fact that smoking these things gives you cancer?
Duh. It's good for you. It's actually good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we.
How about the seatbelt one?
Yes. Like.
Yeah.
All of these, you know, we've seen this story play out over and over and over again. We know that conspiracies are a real thing, and yet.
Safe and effective. Too soon? Yeah. What it is? It's a legacy media apparatus that is very bad at informing the public. We have a very bad, very, very bad, regardless of whatever side you're on that says this is a government propaganda machine or a truly incompetent media thing, right? Whatever side you're on, they're just bad. Like people can't magically just like know the right solution, you know? Put aside the fact that, you know, 75% plus of this country is either living paycheck to paycheck or they're so busy that they can't pay attention to anything outside of their house. And then the only thing they can rely on from an information perspective most of the time historically has been these legacy media outlets, written, TV, cable, whatever you want to call it, that try to inform the public on, like, let's say federal level information or like information that comes down from the entity that takes most of your money from in form of taxes, right? That media apparatus has been so incredibly poor at informing the public. And the only reason why podcasts have become so popular and the reason why independent voices have become so popular is because there's been a gigantic gap in quality and value of information that has been missing from legacy media outlets. This whole movement of podcasts and independent voices and social media personalities, whatever level of quality that those people, you know, like us, for example, we only exist because legacy media sucks. If legacy media was good, we wouldn't need to be here because then the information we're getting would be good, you know? And then instead you have two idiots on this screen right now trying to figure out what the fuck is happening. Like, how is this even real? But at the same time, that's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing long term because it's like, okay, so what's one thing that the United States education is very bad at, in my opinion, right? Critical thinking. I don't think our school system, our public school system, does a good job whatsoever at teaching critical thinking, okay?
Or financial education of any form.
Or financial literacy. Horrendous. Like, how come, like, when you graduate high school, if you're just going through the public school curriculum, does anyone know how the stock market works? Does anybody know what inflation is? Does anyone know what the market cap of a company means? You know what I'm saying? Do you understand how bonds, what is a bond even? Bro, like the concept of a bond, I had to learn in, like, after college, because I'm like, I couldn't conceptualize what a bond was. You know what I'm saying? Like, and then our entire monetary system is dependent on bonds existing and debt and inflation. Like, oh, this whole thing collapses without those three things. And how many people graduating high school at 18 years old actually understand that concept? I want to guess less than 1%.
I didn't.
Okay. Huge. How is it that the most fundamental part of capitalism is not understood by literally everybody graduating high school?
Well, so, I mean, this takes us back to a statement that Eric made in his Chris Williamson podcast that was pretty provocative, and I'm still chewing on it. I don't know how fully to take this red pill, but he said, you know, the purpose of the mainstream media, and we'll include in here the U.S. educational system, is not to inform you. It is to instruct you on how to feel. And when you look at it through that lens, it's provocative, because thinking about headlines and classes that exist versus classes that don't exist and all these things, it's like, oh, maybe there's something to that you need to signal that you are in support of the correct set of things in order to, you know, go along to get along. It's when you break rank and you're willing to talk about some conspiratorial things, you know, that's when you could be subject to very, especially in polite society, very, very uncomfortable Thanksgiving dinners, or potentially arguments now with your spouse because you don't align on the long laundry list of things, or, hey, we're going to come and take your kids away from you because you expressed dissent from the religious dogma, you know?
Yeah. And so I'm going to play devil's advocate and then I'm going to contradict myself. Ready? So, so my devil's advocate take on that is that the reason why legacy media has been so bad is because we, with the age of the internet, their ability to generate income has been drastically disrupted. And the best way for them to generate income is to align the information they're giving the public to interact with our primal systems as much as possible so that they can bring attention, which generates a ton of divisiveness. And by default is geared to make you as scared as possible. Right. And so this conspiratorial thing, like, hey, let's actually talk about what is happening, instead of like, Donald Trump is trying to end democracy, which is a conspiracy in its own. Right. You can't take a clip of him joking around about being a dictator on day one and just trying to drive that to everybody, right? There's so many instances. I'm not, again, not an endorsement of Trump, but you can't deny that there is countless examples of legacy media taking everything he has said, almost everything he said, out of context, right? Which diminishes their ability to call out when he actually says something really, really dumb, because then you're like, I don't trust you. Why should I trust you? You've lied to me 1,000 times, right? So that dynamic is what's driving how they're driving information. But then my rebuttal to my own devil's advocate position is that, okay, if that was true, then how come Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson are way more popular than anything legacy media has created? Why is that the case? They, you know, regardless if you agree with them or not, and like Jimmy Dore and like, you know, Bill Maher, like, let's not even talk about independent right voices like Jimmy Dore, Bill Maher. There's a bunch of other folks out there like the Young Turks, you know, Breaking Points. There's so, like, go down the list. There's all these different voices that are way bigger than anything these channels can muster, these legacy media outlets, and they don't feed you the narrative. They don't feed you the thing, you know? So what is that?
Yeah, the other counterpoint that I would say that the economic challenges are definitely a factor here. But then that's when I would say, okay, let's rewind the tape to before the economic challenges existed, and was the quality of the information, you know, were you being more informed by Walter Cronkite than you are by whoever, you know, the news anchor du jour is? And I know that people felt a lot better about the narrative that they were being fed under Walter Cronkite, but I just, you know, categorically reject the idea that state-sponsored media ever did a great job of informing people of any of the things that were counter to the narrative. And that's where, you know, this rise in not only hunger for information, but hunger for critical thinking about whatever the narrative is, and the full debate with the, you know, opposing sides steel manned that goes along with that. Cause that's something that just, you know, and the other thing that I think is hilarious about that is, you know, the countercultural movement of the 1960s and hippies and get us out of Vietnam. Like, there was a rejection of the story that was being fed to America by the media at that point in time. And it was powerful. It just didn't have the same feeling that it has in this, you know, globally connected online world that we have now.
It was so powerful, they made every drug illegal. That movement that for like all these people saying Vietnam is dumb. And then what was the job that they went after? Let's paint these hippies as drug addicts, psychos that are addicted to all these drugs. I'm sure that was the case in some respects for some people. Okay, I'm not saying this is not 100% true, but I'm sure some of them maybe. But then it was so severe that it ended up making a lot of drugs that today are proving to be vastly beneficial to so many people. It's primarily talking about MDMA, mushrooms, weed, right? These three things. They completely threw in the bus of like, let's make sure that the hippie movement dies because we're tired of this Stop Vietnam thing. Okay?
Yeah, so that we can mass prescribe opiates. Yeah. By doctors, yeah. And create an epidemic of death and suffering for Americans.
And enriching the Sackler family while you're at it, right? Okay.
Was that about conspiracies?
Yeah. That totally happened. Okay. So it's so interesting to think that all these things in the past have happened and then magically that's not happening today.
Yeah, there are no modern day it's impossible. Conspiracies. Or the government is immune from having, you know, all these other large organizations of humans, they are susceptible to conspiracies.
Yeah,
but not ours. Government, just immediately, as soon as you walk through the door into the Capitol, you have just been magically released of your conspiratorial nature. Yeah.
The government that will pay a space company twice the amount of money to do infinitely less work than somebody that does it for half the price. A government that will literally give the military whatever it wants when the military is shooting bullets into the hill, like literally wasting hundreds of thousands of units of ammo and God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars in equipment just so they can re-up their budget next year, right? That incredibly efficient government that is so good at everything would definitely not be doing something that's completely dumb, either on purpose or by accident. It's impossible. And if you talk about it, Hans, you will get banned. You're going to get banned, bud. Be careful. But I don't think we are. But here's the silver lining. I'm going to take it to a positive side here. I do think we've hit a turning point. I think we've hit a turning point. As long as X doesn't get shut down in the United States, there is noise about, hey, there is, you know, they might shut down X in the US, and what's happening in Brazil is just setting the stage for them, you know, in France with arresting what's his face from Telegram. There's like these like democracies, quote unquote, that are shutting down things, right? Well, whatever reason you think, okay. I think, again, maybe too naive, too positive. We'll look back to this tape and see if I'm right or wrong. I think there's something in the air that I'm sensing that says this thing is too big now. It's too unwieldy. It's like the more you try to keep like tamper it down, the worse it's gonna get. Especially with a lot of these independent voices, these podcasts, All In, Theo Vaughn, Lex Friedman, apparently, what's his face? Joe Rogan, like Trump going on this like podcast tour and Trump being like him or not, sort of like the front face of this movement to try and get this apparatus, this drain the swamp movement. Again, jury's out if he's going to be able to do it. With that gaining the steam that it has this election cycle and it making appearances in so many different diverse places where people get their information, those conversations not being squashed, if anything they've been amplified, okay, doesn't that point to we've turned a corner and maybe there isn't this like Elon type carrying the flag for free speech, let's say, right? But there's like not this, there's not this effort or like this lack of effort to stop evil from happening. They're actually just saying, listen, this is just information. I don't, what do you want me to do? You want me to stop it? I'm not going to stop it. Because they already have the guy up there in Elon that's saying, fuck you, I'm going to put this on the internet. You're not going to stop me. And so YouTube's like, are we going to get in trouble if we don't stop it? Just let's see what happens. You know, and Zuckerberg with like, and in the US, we're strategically saying, I regret it. You know? So that to me, however soft, that to me feels like a turning point. And it feels like we're going to go, better days are ahead. But I don't know.
I certainly hope so. I feel like we haven't seen enough very painful sacrifices in order to achieve that yet. I don't think that the sufficient cost in blood has been paid yet to preserve those freedoms.
So you're sort of like making this,
so this is a reference to Rene Girard and mimetic theory and his idea that, you know, there are sacrifices that have to be made to cleanse, you know, a public consciousness.
Isn't the Trump attempted assassination that?
I think it's the beginning of that, but I'm concerned that we haven't seen enough yet. That was, you know, a drop in the bucket of what is necessary in order to really get to the other side of this in any sort of meaningful and healthy way. And we certainly, you know, we haven't seen the people who are responsible for the censorship be held to account or removed from their positions. There's still very much an open conflict of ideas and institutions of power. I would say that one of the, you know, I don't know how to think about how fortunate it is that Elon decided to do SpaceX, you know, to start SpaceX for that to be successful, to start Tesla for that to be successful as the underlying foundation on which he can then purchase something like Twitter, turn it into X, and try to preserve free speech. That not only from a capital standpoint, but just strategically, you know, if SpaceX is able to accomplish what he wants it to be able to accomplish and be technically, physiologically capable of creating a self-sustaining colony on Mars, the force that can colonize another planet is a greater force from an information and just pure military might standpoint than anything we have today on Earth. And that gives him an amount of leverage to protect him that without it, I don't think that he can try to be the champion for free speech that he is. I mean, just think about the ability of, you know, if SpaceX were a country instead of a company, and they're able to manufacture hundreds and then thousands of Starship rockets, they can dominate the operating domain of space, and they can do hypersonic point-to-point transport on Earth that is literally unstoppable by any current technology. That, like, it doesn't matter if you can see a Starship coming, that doesn't mean that you can do anything about it because it's moving too fast. Like, those are hard power assets that really reshape the future of humanity, period, regardless of whether or not we make it to Mars. And the people that stand behind that technology end up getting to make decisions that are going to shape the future of human history.
Yeah. Do you think him posting a picture of Kamala Harris in a communist outfit, do you think that is making it harder for him to reach that goal? And is it a complete self-own when you're trying to do that? When you're trying to say these are the things at stake, right? What's the thought process behind that?
Definitely picking a bone with some very powerful people. But Elon doesn't back down from a fight. He's not the type to walk away from, you know, Russians spitting on him, calling him a silly idiot for thinking that he can just come over there and buy an intercontinental ballistic missile to go to Mars. He's like, actually, you know what? I can do that. So
can you believe it? Like, those guys could be responsible for everything. Those guys that literally spit on him for trying to buy an ICBM, a decommissioned ICBM, or a ICBM without the B, whatever, intercontinental.
Just no ballistic. Warhead. Yeah.
No warhead. That's still right.
Yeah. It's still an intercontinental ballistic missile. It just doesn't have the go the boom part on the end.
Yeah. They're like, you silly American, I spit on your shoes, get out of here. And then he's like, I'm going to start my own rocket company.
Fate loves irony.
This guy is insane. He's so wild. He's so crazy. It's so crazy. Like, and then, you know, because when I saw that meme on X, I'm like, here we go. And I replied to, like, Matt Smith, the worst human you'll ever meet in your life, literal douchebag. I hate Matt Smith. I want to make sure that's clear. You know, he says, like, hey, like, why, like, you talked about reducing attack vectors to yourself, and then you go and post this. Like, why are you doing that? And I'm like, you know what? That's a great point. Like, why are you doing that? Like, let them dig their own grave. Why are you joining them in the grave? And then we go through this story, and you think about his entire arc. He's like, oh yeah, no, this is nothing. Like, it very much fits within the context of who he is. It's just, it's hitting that tribal thing, right? Like, the, oh no, you're talking about my team, the thing that I think is going to save the country, Kamala Harris, because it's not going to allow a dictator to come to power. You are evil, right, for doing that. So it's just the context is different. Clive's very upset about that meme.
Yes.
Can you hear him?
Incredibly. Yeah. The one of the things that I think about is Sam Bankman-Fried.
Alex Karp.
He's also crazy hair. No, when Sam Bankman-Fried was talking about how, you know, all of the crazy positions that you're supposed to take socially as part of polite society in certain elite institutions, they're just shibboleths. They're just the things that you have to say in order to signal that you're part of the in-group and that you have gotten the memo on whatever, you know, whatever the rotating padlock, you know, encryption key is to be allowed into the inner sanctum of the people that make decisions. And like, that is offensive to Elon personally. And he's like, oh, whatever the things that you're supposed to say are, yeah, like, bullshit. And that's what, you know, calling right now the most in thing that you're supposed to say is that this person who literally the entire country thought of was a joke 2 months ago is now the most fit person on the face of the earth to be the sole possessor of the nuclear codes.
Wild. It, like, objectively wild. Like, it's objectively wild that is actually reality, you know. Not saying Trump is, like, I, you know, I will say Trump is better. Trump seems better than that. Still not going to vote for him, but that statement in itself is so insane to even ponder that out of nowhere, this... Okay, can I tell you my theory behind that? Can I tell you my theory behind why Kamala Harris is the...
I mean, you know candidate? Me. I'm definitely open to entertaining conspiracy theories.
Okay. The only reason why she's running for president and why Tim Walz is her sidekick and is not like Ben Shapiro or not Ben Shapiro. Oh my God. Josh, the guy from Pennsylvania. Josh Shapiro, yeah. But you know, listen to some of the stuff he says. Seems like a very capable politician. I don't trust him, but you know, whatever. The only reason why she's president and that's or running for president, that's why hers is, it's because literally every other politician is looking at the landscape and they're like, there's no way I can beat Trump this election cycle. Dude, the dude almost died from a shot to the head. There's this giant populist movement. You know, we have a president in office that just steps aside and disappears for whatever reason. I'm not going to commit political suicide going up against Trump. Am I crazy? And so that's why you saw like the immediate endorsement of Kamala. Like all the people, like this open primary that was supposed to happen, all these people are like, there is no way I'm going to run for president in a shortened election cycle and against Trump. Let's just throw Kamala to the wolves, but masquerade it as like, yay, the best person ever. Go ahead and debate him. Good luck in those interviews. We support you. You're going to do great. I think that's what happened. I don't think it's this grand conspiracy of like a coup for Biden. I think Biden was extremely stubborn and his ego got the better of him. He put himself in a stupid situation. Then he waited too long to step aside. And then when he finally stepped aside, there wasn't enough time. And then people are like, oh no, Kamala's great. And now Kamala is like, I am great. Mm-hmm. And then she's going to get destroyed. Just like she did in 2020. You know, the second she became the front runner and the second she got challenged, she folded immediately. And I don't see how the last 3.5 years will change that story. I just don't, I could be wrong. Listen, I'm not a political strategist. I'm new to this thing, but like, I'm just like trying to objectively come up with a thing, especially when you have a thing where Trump is going to, on all these like talks on podcasts and stuff, long form. You can hear him think through his ideas. You can listen to the policy closer. You can start to judge character a little bit better. Right. And then Kamala is behind this concrete wall. She has a heavily edited interview with CNN, which by the way, Dana Bash, she's getting a lot of shit. I thought it was okay. I don't think she did a terrible job. She had some good questions. She followed up sometimes. And then I'm like, okay, this seemed like a little bit more, this was a little bit better CNN showing than the usual CNN showing. It's the point I'm trying to make. I'm trying to encourage them to do better, right? I'm like, okay, not the worst interview I've ever seen. But even then, heavily edited. I have no idea like what are the other questions you asked from that 45-hour-long interview and you're only showing 18 minutes. Like, I get it. You want to captivate the people's audience, but read the room, y'all. There's podcasts. The reason why podcasts are huge is because people are craving for that long form. And you're telling me an hour, 2-hour-long conversation with Kamala is not going to do that great? Okay, if it's not going to do that great, maybe the candidate sucks. Okay? Maybe she shouldn't be president. Okay, so like, why is that controversial? You know, because not Trump is no longer a good, it was never a good reason. It's definitely not a good reason now. So like, you know, where was I going with this? Oh, my theory behind Kamala. Where should yeah. So that's my theory.
It's an entertaining theory. I think there are elements of it that are true, but my predictive algorithm, you know, I thought it was quite hilarious when Jason was predicting that we were going to have the Biden dropout and then that we were going to get a speed run primary.
Hot swap summer, right?
Yeah. Well, so he, and I didn't think it was hilarious that he thought that Biden was going to drop out. I actually was like, that's actually likely. But I did not think that a speed run primary where we get, you know, a great candidate like a Dean Phillips was ever in a million years going to be allowed to happen, which was, yeah, I mean, that was the, you know, kind of the underlying sentiment that it seemed like Jason was advocating for, is like, let's get Biden out of here. He's obviously terrible. We need somebody who's hip and with the times and a good critical thinker and someone who's good for the country up there instead of Biden. And that's because you think that the placement of Biden in the Oval Office was an accident instead of on purpose. Like, my pushback to your theory would be the same as my pushback to Jason's theory. If this is about throwing Kamala to the wolves, who's running the country now? Who's been running it while Joe Biden has been in office this whole time?
Who cares? It's been happening like this for the last 4 years. Why do you think there's so much weirdness going on?
I'm saying that whoever that is,
it's a rhetorical question.
Control of whoever the next candidate is. That the, you know, if Joe Biden is a puppet for the apparatus, then the only other candidate who can possibly be advanced against Trump is also a puppet for the apparatus. And that's where I think Kamala Harris fits the bill perfectly to a T. She is, you know, the absolute representation of a puppet.
So that, here's the thing.
Every policy she's ever endorsed publicly in the past has now been wiped clean. And she will just say and do at this point in time whatever the apparatus has wanted to do and has been doing.
Yeah. She's a politician, right? So we're saying the same thing, I think. The apparatus in my head is what I just described, is a dynamic where there are self-serving politicians that are looking after their own power and their own ability to gain that power and not so much the public's best interest. And that dynamic is what's causing somebody like her to be front and center running for president.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, you're looking at the actors on the stage and I'm looking at the directors. You're saying that the politicians themselves, who I would, you know, identify as the actors on the stage, are the ones making the decisions, or, you know, they have a significant ability to look out for their own interests. And I think that is less likely than, I mean, they can to a certain degree, but only to, you know, to the extent that it serves the interests of the people that are behind them.
And so what you're saying is like lobbyist money, super PAC money behind, you know, closed door deals. That's what's driving a lot of this. Not so
whatever
much.
It is inside of the Democratic Party that selects who the candidate is. You know, yeah. I don't know exactly what the shape of that is or not. And you know, this same thing existed inside of the Republican Party as well. And, you know, Trump just had the ridiculous personality and money to be able to break through whatever that thing was. And no one in the Democratic Party has yet been able to do that, even though, you know, a Tulsi Gabbard or a Bernie Sanders, or, you know, there's a number of figures who have been good potentials for the party. But they just didn't have the resources and the backing in order to be able to make that group of people who decides who's in and who's out bend the knee.
And what's interesting about what you're saying is that, you know, if I think about my time as a Democrat, like Democrats are very much pro-system people. Like they have a lot of trust in systems. Like the whole concept behind, I think, being a Democrat nowadays is that you have a lot of trust that the experts and the systems are looking out for the best for the society. And so by default, if that is the makeup of the party, why wouldn't that thinking and that application apply to the party that selects the candidates, right? So by default, if you're somebody who has that predisposition, the party that you're in will have that predisposition as well. And so I think that describes why. What's wild to me is that Bernie is backing it. Like, that's the crazy part. Like, you can tell Bernie is an independent thinker. I, in my opinion, I like Bernie a lot. as a human being, I like Bernie a lot. I think he really cares about America. I really think so, truly, like to my heart. I really think so. But he like very reluctantly, Joe Biden's the best chance we have to beat Donald Trump. Yep. Kamala Harris is the best chance we have to beat Donald. Like, no, it's you. What the fuck? It's you.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
It's you. Man.
He is the Occupy Wall Street candidate. And, yeah. You know, that movement is a very populist movement. And it is, you know, somewhat disappointing to see him not stand up even more strongly for his ideals like RFK Jr. has done and like Tulsi have done. I would say the thing where I see a really big civil war happening right now is that a lot of the money that funds the Democratic Party has been coming from tech. And they, you know, the Democratic Party has been super friendly with tech up until recently. And now with the rise of social media and this back and forth that's going on, they are alienate. Like, it is no longer a assumed social position that if I'm a successful person in tech, that I'm going to support the Democratic Party anymore. That is becoming a much more open question. And now we're seeing a lot of, you know, figures from Silicon Valley defect. And so this anti-tech sentiment is something that, you know, has the potential to alienate their donor base to the point that they lose, you know, really undermining the decision makers who have, you know, taken tech people for granted as implicit supporters. So Elon is part of that, but obviously he's not the only one. There's, you know, a number of prominent figures in Silicon Valley who, in fact, it seems to be more of the people that I know of are openly expressing opposition to the Democratic Party than support. Like Vinod Khosla is the only major VC that I can think of that I know of. And Reid Hoffman, that are still, you know, staunchly inside Team Blue. So, yeah.
Outspoken about being in Team Blue, at least. And so, like, what's interesting about that is, like, okay, so what is the thing that keeps California ticking this whole time? It's Silicon Valley. Like California doesn't really, I mean, Hollywood maybe to an extent, but not so much anymore. But Silicon Valley is the economic powerhouse of California. If a lot of those guys are starting to defect to the red side, are we sure California is going to be a blue state in the coming decade, 8 years, right? What is that going to do to the... That's a lot of freaking delegates. It's the most delegates in the country. That, I mean, can you imagine if California votes red in one of these elections because of that giant defection, right? Because you would think, like, if the VCs are all going Republican, let's say, or a majority of them going Republican, you don't think that's going to have a downstream effect to the rest of the state in some way, you know? I don't know. I could be wrong.
I don't know. Yeah.
When you go to California, though, I mean, people are definitely a very specific. a lot of people have a very specific viewpoint, but in the city anyway, which is very normal city, for most states.
I mean, that's what one of the environments that I grew up in was Oregon, and the entire state by geography was red, but then you had three blue cities and the state is blue.
Yeah. Pennsylvania is very similar. I mean, literally, yeah, Pennsylvania is super similar. Like most of the state, I grew up in, I mean, I spent, what, 20 years in Pennsylvania or something? The state is red, but then Harrisburg, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, blue. You know, Texas, not kind of. Texas is very red. And then Houston and Austin are blue. But I don't know if the other cities are that blue. You know, there's a lot of big cities here. Dallas is red, you know. Anyway. Wild times, but I agree. I think the VC thing is very interesting, and the tech piece moving red. I think it's a tell for what's to come. which is that I think that's such an interesting point you made. Like the money that has funded the Democratic Party for this period of time, and the ones, and by default, tech. Okay, so should we save this for another day? Because I really want to talk about this a little bit more in depth, but I think this is a good place.
Let's just keep talking about it, and then if we split it up into two episodes, we split it up into two episodes.
Well, the only reason is because I have to edit it, and then I have to go. I have like a limited window. I don't have.
More, oh, gotcha, more gotcha. Than,
yeah, yeah. So I think I'm gonna save it, but like this.
Yeah.
That within the context of what we just talked about. So what definitely does policy look like? You know,
the vast majority of all new GDP is going to come from the tech sector. And if you make all the tech people hate your party,
I know
it's only a matter of time before you just ran yourself out of money, because all the new money is coming from people that you have openly declared war upon.
That's what it feels like. That's what it feels like to me. And then, so are we going to have this like inversion now, right? In the next 10 to 20 years, with the age of artificial intelligence, with the age of automation, where the party that's going to drive that innovation, let's say, is the Republican Party, but then all the people that are displaced and affected by that innovation or revolution, that populist movement goes blue. So like in 20 years time, 10 to 20 years time, will the populace, that's my prediction. I don't see how this doesn't happen. There will definitely be displacement of labor from automation, like it or not. When we have self-driving cars, we don't need drivers anymore. When we have humanoid robots, we don't need laborers anymore. In the current context, right? Over time, those folks, hopefully, open question, how is society going to handle this? Those folks are going to land, hopefully, in better places. That's the theory. But you're telling me there's not going to be a transition period, right? That transition period is going to drive a gigantic populist movement, just like all the manufacturing leaving the United States in the last 30, 40 years drove a populist movement on the Republican side through Trump, right? That's his core base. That's all the people that their families had a lot of money and they had good jobs, and all those jobs left America. And they're like, what the hell happened? You're not looking after me. And so they lashed on to the guy that's going to break the system to like make it work for them. I don't see how this doesn't happen again, but in the age of automation, where the jobs don't go away overseas, the jobs just go away. They just go away. And the period of time from jobs being there to jobs being there again, but the next generation of jobs, whatever that means, that transition period needs to be filled with something. And I think that's what's going to happen. If I'm just trying to extrapolate time forward, you know? Yeah. Anyway. Just teeing up the next discussion,
I think there are ways to get from here to there. One of them being some entity funding to make sure that every human gets a robot. Like, if instead of having a job, you have a robot that does a bunch of stuff for you.
That'd be sick. Like literally every American gets a bot.
Yeah.
Every American gets a bot.
I mean, every human, we have to get to a place eventually where every human has one. And so what is the mechanism by which we can make that happen? I think at first it starts by, you know, organizations or individuals buying them, but yeah, I think that the likelihood that, because, you know, what's cheaper? Like, we already have huge social welfare programs that spend lots and lots of money on all kinds of different things. Like, if we get the price of making a bot down to $25,000, $15,000, $10,000, like, there are, we already give way more than that to the people who are most disadvantaged in our communities. Super easy to include a bot in whatever assistance that we're providing to these people.
It almost becomes like a utility that is funded by the government, like how we have water and electricity and the internet, let's say. You know, those are like the utilities we have right now as a society. Like the other one is just labor. Like, here you go. Like government funded labor that's going to help you free up your time so that you can go out and bring value to society, right? Cleaning up the house, running errands for you, whatever, mowing the lawn, washing dishes, just helping you carry stuff around the house, dangling this toy in front of the baby, keep them a little entertained while you go poop. Just the little things in life that I'm starting to learn are very valuable. You know? Wow. That's crazy, huh? Okay. Yeah, we need to talk about this. This is fun. Yeah. Maybe we'll make that topic of the discussion. Should we invite JD back for Friday? Because he got ass.
Yeah.
He got that juicy ass. Yeah.
Yeah, we should do that. That would be a great one.
Actually, Smart Summon, by the way, folks. I'm going to ask him to see if he's open, and then we can talk that stuff. And then we should talk about this topic with him, too, because I think he's keenly interested in this shit, too. I think that'd be sick. What do you think?
I'm good with it. Obviously, I'm willing to make a fool of myself. I know a lot of people are going to have, you know, take issue with the conversation that we had today, but that's okay.
What do you think we've done for the last hour and 40 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. So
literally that's what we do.
We can keep doing it. And I mean, yeah. Just to say one thing on that topic, like it or not, political positions or not, the reality of the situation is that Elon Musk's arc is increasingly colliding with these societal and political hot topics. And that is why if we want to understand how that arc is going to play out over time, we need to have the freedom to talk about how all of these other forces are interacting with his arc and how his arc is interacting with those other forces. Otherwise, we're just going to be completely blindsided by what ends up happening instead of, you know, it is the process of these types of conversations, right or wrong, that helps us whittle down the space of possibilities and really kind of feel like we can come to a pretty high likelihood understanding of what are the most likely outcomes going to be.
We can't have like the Rockefeller / Edison / Tesla of our time and not talk about it. Like it would be so silly to not build some sort of historical database of what the fuck's happening, you know, of two idiots at least trying to make sense of what's happening. Let's add a little bit more data. So talk about it, y'all. Comment section, go. Bye. All right. Wonderful.
Tell us how dumb we are.
Yeah, tell us how dumb we are. More than you already do. All right. Beautiful.